And yet... She took a second look around, a more careful look, seeing her surroundings with a fresh eye and, to her surprise, recognizing what she saw. At first, she couldn't believe it. She was still struggling with the idea that somehow she had been transported in her sleep, drug-induced, she was certain, to a strange and terrible place, all for reasons that were not yet apparent. Disoriented and confused, she had misread what was now patently clear. The land she was looking at, although now turned lifeless and empty, was the land she had gone to sleep in last night. She was still in Callahorn, in the Four Lands. Yet it was not the Callahorn she knew, and from what she could see of it, only a ruined shell of the Four Lands. She sat staring off into the distance, her gaze shifting from feature to make certain. She took note of the dragon's teeth, their jagged outline unmistakable, as familiar to her by then as her own face. And there, a glimpse of the Myrmidons, south and west, where the mountains broke apart. The plateau on which she sat was where the druid's keep had stood. North, south, east, and west, the geography was just as it had been for thousands of years. But blasted and leached of life, a corpse of the sort she had thought herself to be on waking. And where was Paranor? She could reach only one conclusion. Either she had awakened in the aftermath of the Great Wars or gone into a future in which a similar catastrophe had occurred. But that was impossible. She checked herself carefully to make certain she was all in one piece, and having done so, managed to get to her feet. Her dizziness and the sluggish feel of waking from a deep sleep had worn off, and her strength was beginning to return. She gave it a few more minutes, still puzzling through her situation, still trying to make sense of it. She couldn't, of course. There was no way to do so without knowing both where she was and how she had gotten there. She realized she was hungry, and she started to look for food. In her world, the one she had left behind that looked like this one but apparently wasn't, there would have been berry bushes in a clearing near a stream not far from where she stood. While Ard Rhys, she had gone there from time to time to pick the fruit, a private, secret indulgence about which only Tagwyn knew. But it was unlikely that such sweet fruit grew anywhere in this world. Her hunger would have to wait. She started to walk through the trees, looking for water. As she walked, she listened futilely for the sounds of other life. What sort of world was she in where there were no birds? Were there any people, any creatures at all? Was it possible that she was the only living thing there? The forest was empty and dead, smelling of its own decay. The gray light was unchanging and oppressive, and the sky remained empty of sun, moon, or stars, even of clouds. The dark, ruined world felt incomplete, as if it were only a faintly cast shadow of the real world. She found a stream, finally, but the water looked so foul she decided against drinking it. She sat down again, her back against a blighted oak, and looked off into the shadowed trees, into the distance, reasoning out what had happened. Clearly she hadn't come on her own. Someone had caused her to be transported. She could safely assume it had not been done for her benefit. Most likely, given the number of enemies she had made, it had been done to get her out of the way. Further, it had been done using magic, because there was no other explanation for how something so difficult could have been accomplished. Yet no one she knew possessed such magic. Not even she could transport people to other places. So perhaps it had been accomplished by someone who was not of her world, but of another. But what world would that be? Surely not this one. She gave up thinking about it finally, deciding that she should walk to the edge of the bluff for a better look around. Something else must exist in the place, another creature, another life form. If she could find it, whatever it was, she might be able to determine where she was. If she could do that, she would have a better idea of how to get back to where she belonged. The walk took her only a short time, though it left her winded and fatigued. She wasn't herself yet, and she would have to be careful how she expended her energy until she was. Thin and diaphanous, her night clothes billowed about her as she walked. They were warm enough for the moment, but totally inadequate for the task at hand. They would deteriorate quickly. Yet where would she find anything to replace them? When she stood again upon the heights, close to the bluff edge and still in the shadow of the lifeless trees, she began a slow scan of the countryside, searching for movement that would identify life. She was in the middle of this search, completely absorbed in her efforts, when the Dracha appeared. Her concentration was so intense that at first she didn't even know it was there, but in its eagerness to reach her, it stepped upon some twigs and gave itself away. Even so, it was on her so quickly that she barely had time to react. At the last possible moment, she threw herself to one side as it lunged for her, leathery wings spread wide, jaws snapping. She managed to avoid the jaws, but one wing caught her a glancing blow and sent her spinning. The breath left her lungs as she slammed into a tree trunk, and the air before her eyes danced with dark spots.
"Hadracha," she thought in disbelief. "It can't be. It's not possible. They don't exist anymore."
But there it was, nevertheless, wheeling about to come at her again. It was big for a Dracha, fully 20 feet long from nose to tail and wingtip to wingtip, sinuous body heavily muscled and covered with glistening scales, back ridged with spines and razor-edged plates, legs crooked and claw-tipped. Knowing she was dead if she didn't act quickly, she righted herself against the tree trunk and screamed the magic of the wish song at the beast. Her voice was hoarse and raw from her long sleep, the magic badly managed and scattershot at best, but it was enough. It caught up the Dracha and threw it away as if it were made of straw. The creature hissed and shrieked, enraged at what was being done to it. She saw the fury mirrored in its lidded yellow eyes. She saw it in the twist and snap of its scaly body as it tumbled away into the trees. Then her voice gave out. She was still too weak to sustain the magic for more than a few seconds. She staggered to her feet, watching as the damaged beast hauled itself upright, dazed and battered, but still dangerous. It turned toward her, eyes glistening from the shadow of its horned brow, the sound of its breathing heavy and thick with anger. Long neck extended, it flicked its tongue out from between rows of dagger-sharp teeth. It stared at her balefully for a long moment, weighing its options. She held her ground, staring back. If she tried to run, it would be on her in seconds. All she could do was to run her bluff and hope it worked. For a moment, she was certain it wouldn't. The Dracha was too furious even to think of backing away. It would come for her because that was its nature. It was a dragon, and dragons were relentless. It would not back away until one of them was dead. But then it surprised her. Perhaps it decided she wasn't worth the trouble after all, that she was too dangerous, that there was easier prey. It spat venom, came toward her a few steps in menacing fashion, then turned away almost disdainfully and disappeared into the trees. She took a deep breath to steady herself. A Dracha. There hadn't been Drachas in the world in thousands of years, not since the time of Faerie. There were dragons still, though only a few, hidden in the mountains, in deep caves and bottomless crevices, in places far beyond the reach of men. But no Drachas, no small flying dragons of that sort. She took a long moment to consider what encountering one meant. Her thinking shifted. There were no dragons in the aftermath of the Great Wars. There were barely any humans. Was she somewhere farther back in time, before the age of humans, when only fairy creatures existed? That would explain the presence of the Dracha and the absence of Perenor. It would explain why the geography of the world about her looked so familiar, yet was devoid of buildings like Perenor. There would have been no buildings and no people in the first age when the world was still new, populated by fairy creatures that required no shelter save that provided by nature. But had the age of Faerie been so bleak? She hadn't thought so from her readings. She had not imagined it possible. That world was newly made and fresh. This world was dying. A rustle in the branches overhead drew her attention. The sound was so slight that she almost missed it. But her encounter with the Dracha had put her on guard, and so she glanced up and caught sight of the creature. She stepped back automatically, tensing in expectation of a second attack, but what she found instead of another Dracha was some sort of monkey. It skittered through the trees on spindly limbs, flashes of its hairy, gnarled form appearing through breaks in the ragged boughs. Having been seen, it was trying frantically to escape. Impulsively, she yelled at it. She didn't pause to think about what she was doing, merely acted on an instinctive need to stop whatever it was from getting away. She was successful. Startled by the sound of her voice, the creature lost its grip and fell, tumbling end over end through the limbs to land with an audible grunt not a dozen yards from where she stood. It lay dazed and twitching as she walked over to it, and she glanced about as she approached in case it had friends in hiding. But no others appeared, and this one seemed barely able to draw breath after its long fall. It lay on its side, panting heavily, face upturned to the sky. She changed her mind about it as she got closer. It wasn't a monkey, after all. It was hard to say what it was. What it most resembled was a spider gnome, but it wasn't that either. Whatever it was easily the ugliest creature she had ever seen. It was barely 4 feet tall. Its body was all out of proportion, with bony protrusions and elongated limbs. Coarse black hair sprouted in thick patches from the top of its head and from its dark, leathery skin through rents in its worn pants and tunic. It recovered and struggled up, still trying to get away from her. She grabbed it by the scruff of the neck and held it fast, holding it away from her as it tried to bite her, using teeth that were considerably sharper than her own. She shook it hard and hissed at it, and it quit trying to bite. It hung limply in her grasp for a moment, then began to chatter wildly. It spoke a language she didn't recognize, but the cadence and tonal repetition suggested it might be a derivation of the tongues with which she was familiar. She shook her head to show she didn't understand. The creature just kept talking, faster now, gesturing wildly. She answered, trying various gnome dialects. It paused to listen, then shook its own head in reply and began to chatter again. It was so animated that it was bobbing up and down as it spoke, giving it the look of a disjointed puppet, its limbs manipulated by hidden strings. She set it down and released it, pointing at it in warning to keep it from trying to flee again. It frowned at her and folded its arms over its chest, managing to look defiant and frightened at the same time. She tried a handful of dwarf and troll dialects, but it didn't seem to understand those either. Each time it would stop and listen to her words, then start chattering away in its own language, as if through insistence and repetition she could be made to understand. Finally it plopped down in the grass, arms folded over its chest, eyes turned away, mouth set in a disapproving line. She saw the knife at its waist for the first time, an odd-shaped, narrow blade that curved and was serrated at the tip. She saw a small pouch attached to a belt, both decorated with beads sewn into the leather. The pockets cut into the sides of its worn pants were sculpted with thread. Whatever species it was advanced beyond the spider gnome level. By the same token, it wasn't a member of any race she could put a name to. She gave up on the dwarf and troll dialects and was about to give up on the creature as well, thinking that it was hopeless, that she should leave it and move on, go hunt for something else. Then she decided, rather impulsively, to try speaking to it in the elven language, even though the creature looked nothing like an elf. But the elves were the oldest species in the world, and their language had been around the longest. The response was immediate. The creature shifted to a variation of what she was speaking at once, and she could understand him clearly. "Stupid woman," it snapped, the words strange sounding in the odd dialect, but comprehensible. "Yelling at me like that. Look what you did to me. Look how far I fell. I could have broken every bone in my body." He rubbed his arms as if for emphasis, daring her to contradict him. She narrowed her gaze at him. "You should watch what you say to me. If I don't like what I hear, I might break every bone anyway." He grimaced. "I could hurt you if I wanted. You ought to be afraid of me." His odd face scrunched up and his tongue licked out like a cat's, revealing the razor-sharp teeth. "Who are you? Are you a witch?" She shook her head. "No. I am Ard Rhys of Perenor. I am a druid." "Where am I?" He stared blankly at her. "What's wrong with you? Why don't you know where you are? Are you lost?" He didn't wait for an answer.
Tell me what you did to that Dracha. Magic, wasn't it? I've never seen anything like that. If you aren't a witch, you must be a sorceress. Or a Strachan. Are you a Strachan?
There was another name she hadn't encountered outside of the druid histories. Strachans were powerful magic wielders out of the world of faerie, gone for thousands of years. Like the Dracha.
Is this the fairy world? She asked, beginning to think it must be.
The spindly creature stared at her, head cocked.
This is the land of the Jarka Rus. You're inside the dragon line above Pashanon. You must know that. Where is it you come from?
Paranor. Callahorn. The Four Lands. She paused with each name, searching his eyes for recognition and finding none. But the words Jarka Rus meant something to her. She had heard them before, though she couldn't remember where.
What are you? She asked him. What race do you belong to? Are you a troll?
Ulk Bog, he announced proudly. He smiled, showing all his considerable teeth. But I don't have a home at present because I'm traveling. This country is too dangerous. Dragons everywhere, all sorts, and they like to eat my kind. Of course, I try to eat their eggs, so I guess it's fair they should try to eat me. But they're much bigger than I am, for the most part, so I have to be careful. Anyway, I don't want to stay here anymore. Where are you going?
She didn't have the faintest idea, of course, since she didn't even know where she was. She wasn't at all sure she was going anywhere until she figured out what had happened to her. Nevertheless, she pointed west, if only to satisfy him, at the same time trying to figure out how to extract some useful information.
Ah, Hookah Flats. Good choice. Soft earth for burrows and tender rats to eat. He hitched up his belt.
Maybe I should go with you, since you don't seem to know the way.
I know it. I've been everywhere.
Ulk Boggs had disappeared with the world of fairy as well, she was thinking. Everything suggested she had gone back in time to the beginning of things, back before men were created. The idea was so ridiculous that she kept searching for a better answer, but nothing else suggested itself.
Are there lots of dragons here in the dragon line? She pressed.
Big ones, as well as the Drachas.
You are a stranger, aren't you? He said. He was growing bolder again, more confident. He puffed out his narrow chest. Of course there are big ones. Wyverns and frost dragons. Fire drakes, too, though not so many of those. Some live right down here in the forests, like the Drachas. You have to watch out for them all the time. That's how I happen to be up in that...
He stopped himself quickly, looking away into the trees. Well, how I was...
That Dracha I encountered was hunting you, wasn't it? She guessed. She leaned close. Don't lie to me, little rodent.
The Ulk Bog sneered at her. It wasn't my fault it found you instead of me. I didn't do anything to make it come after you. I was just trying to hide in the trees because Drachas don't climb, and they can't fly close in where there are branches that might get in the way of their wings, so I...
She held out her hand beseechingly and stopped him mid-sentence. She doubted he was telling the truth, but then again she wasn't sure he would recognize the truth if it bit him on the nose. There wasn't much about Ulk Bogs in the druid histories, but if they were all like this one, they were pretty good at shifting blame.
Never mind, she told him. It doesn't matter.
She cast about for help from any quarter, but there was none to be found. She was alone and stuck with this fast-talking creature unless she set him free, which she wasn't ready to do quite yet. She still might learn something from him if she gave herself a chance. Even by just letting him rattle on, she might stumble over something that would help.
Tell me your name, she said.
He drew himself up.
Wekka Dart.
What's yours?
Grian.
She abandoned the Ardry's designation because it clearly meant nothing to him.
Tell me more about the dragon line.
Have there ever been any buildings up here on this bluff?
A castle, perhaps?
He laughed. Dragons don't need buildings.
They rule this territory of the Jarkarus. Everything else stays away. If you want buildings, you need to go down onto the plains where the Strakken live. Your kind.
My kind. She remembered suddenly that they were speaking in the Elven tongue, an ancient dialect, but Elven nevertheless, a fairy language. The Elves were the original people, the only true fairy race to survive the Great Wars. There had been Elves forever in the world. If this was the past, even if she was all the way back to the time of the Word, there would be Elves.
Tell me, Wekadart, she said, are there Elves close by? Where do the Elves live?
The look he gave her was filled with disdain.
Are you stupid? There are no Elves here. Elves are forbidden. We cast them out back when we made this world. Jarkarus Bayan Thal Korbo Baz.
She had no idea what he was saying, but she got the message anyway.
But there must be Elves. You were speaking in the Elven tongue.
He became enraged.
I speak Ulkbog, my tongue, my language, and it does not sound anything at all like Elfish. I will hurt you if you say that again, whether you are Strakken or not. No one can call an Ulkbog an elf. We are the free peoples, the world of the Karel Orhen-Pu'u, Jarkarus.
For a moment she was afraid he was going to attack her. His face was twisted in fury, and his breathing had turned quick and dangerous. She could not imagine why he was reacting that way. If he knew about the Elves, this must be the old world, and the Elves had always been a part of it. Not separate from it, not until after the war when the bad fairy creatures had been exiled to... She went still, realization flooding through her, so dark it threatened to bury her in an avalanche of horror.
No, she must be mistaken, she thought.
But she remembered now the origin of the words, Jarkarus. She had never heard them spoken. She had read them. They were words from the Druid histories. Elven words, whether Wekadart liked it or not. They meant banished peoples, and they had been used first in a time before the Four Lands existed, long ago in the beginning, when the war fought between good and evil fairy creatures reached its climax. But she had to be certain.
Ulkbog, she said to him. You say there are dragons. Are there giants as well? Are there demon spawn and goblins? Are there warlocks and witches and ogres?
He nodded at once.
Of course.
She took a deep breath.
Are there furies?
He grinned at her with unsettling purpose. Everywhere. She was frozen by that single word. Everywhere. Furies. No elves, only monsters that preyed on each other and those more helpless. The Elkris had shut them all away thousands of years ago in a place that no human had ever gone into. Until now. She exhaled slowly. She was inside the forbidding.
Chapter 11.
What's wrong with you? Wekadart asked, leaning forward for a closer look, his ferret face wrinkling with something that could have been either suspicion or distaste. Are you going to be sick? You look as if you might be thinking about it. She barely heard him. She was stunned to the point of being unable to speak.
Inside the forbidding.
The words roared in her ears like the howl of a high wind, blotting out every other sound and leaving her wrapped in confusion and disbelief. It was such an impossible idea that she could not bring herself to quit looking for a way to dismiss it. No one had ever been inside the forbidding. There was no way to get inside, for that matter. The barrier was made strong enough to keep the demons and their kind inside, but it had a similar effect on those without. There was no congress between them, not even the smallest contact. Once, 500 years ago, the barrier had ruptured with the failing of the Elkris. Grianne's ancestor, Will Omsford, had been instrumental in helping an elven girl named Amberley, the Chosen of the Tree, find the Bloodfire to create a new Elkris and restore the barrier. But other than that one time, there was no instance in recorded history of demons or humans crossing over from one realm into the other. There was simply no way for it to happen. Yet happen it had, because she was inside the forbidding, and she could argue against it all she wanted, but it was so. If there were furies here, there could be no mistaking it. Weka Dart was an Ulk Bog, and all the Ulk Bogs of ancient times, of fairy, had been sent into the forbidding along with the other creatures who were indiscriminately predatory. The things that lived inside the forbidding were savage and raw, unable to function in a climate of civilized behavior, unable to overcome their instincts for killing. She understood the darkness that drove such creatures, for as the Ill's Witch, it had driven her as well. When the darkness took hold, becoming the hard edge of emotions best kept buried and unexamined, there was no act a creature could not justify. "Do you want some water? I can run for some, not far. I don't like the way you look. Did that Dracha bite you? Are you poisoned?" Weka Dart was pressed so close to her now that his sharp features were only inches from her own. She saw the warts and blemishes on his dark skin where the hair failed to cover them. She saw the sharpness of his teeth and heard the hissing of his breath. It was like looking closely at a weasel. "Back away from me," she said, and he did so instantly, cowering slightly at the harsh sound of her voice. "There's nothing wrong with me, Ulk Bog. I was thinking." Thinking of how desperate her circumstances had become. No situation she could imagine was worse. Being inside the forbidding was a death sentence. She did not know who had found the means to place her there or how she would ever get out again, but she was the Ardres even there, and she held herself together with an iron will forged in countless struggles she had survived and her enemies had not. She took another deep breath and looked around to reassure herself that the geography of the land about her was what she remembered it to be. It hadn't changed. The dragon's teeth formed a barrier on three sides, allowing small glimpses of grasslands and rivers beyond, all of it familiar, while north the Strelaheim stretched away in bleak, misty emptiness. She tried to reason it through. If she was inside the forbidding, then the forbidding was not another place entirely. It was the same place on a different plane of existence, an alternate world and history, one that had progressed little since the time of Faerie. Her world had seen an entire civilization rise and fall in a holocaust of power gone mad. This one had failed to progress beyond the time of its creation out of elven magic, thousands of years ago. One had seen races created out of myth, out of a time when they were real, made new again by the changes wrought in the survivors of the great wars. The other had seen its denizens frozen in time until the myth was reality, born of nightmare. No wonder Weka Dart and probably most of those who lived here spoke a variation of the elven tongue she knew from her studies. Once all creatures had spoken the same tongue, born of the word's magic, given life and a chance at unity that they had tossed away. "Have you always been the banished people?" she asked Weka Dart. "Do you keep histories of this? Does anyone?" "Strakens and warlocks keep our histories, but they do not agree on what it is," the Ulk Bog responded. He rubbed his sharp chin and sneered. "They like to change it to suit their own purposes. Liars and cheats all, but those like myself who are not burdened with magic know the truth. The history is the history. It is not just what anyone says. Charkarus have been here 1,000,000 years, since they chose to be rid of the elves and their kind, to come here and be free." A reasonable interpretation, she thought, for creatures that did not want to see themselves as exiled, but as self-determinative. The irony was that they still referred to themselves as Charkarus, the banished people. Perhaps it was in the nature of all people that they should reinvent themselves to keep their pride and dignity intact. Monsters and demonkind had the same need for self-respect as humans. She stopped herself in mid-thought, aware that she had missed something. "Are there others here like me?" she asked, thinking that since she had been sent here out of her own world, perhaps others had as well. "Strakens? Of course." "No, not Strakens. Humans." He stared at her. "What are humans?"
"People who look like me.
smooth-skinned. She tried to figure out what else she could say. Anyone who looks like me. He looked uneasy.
Like you?
Some, not many. Strakens and warlocks and witches can look like anything with their magic. He rubbed his hands together nervously and looked about.
Can we go? That Dracha probably has friends. It might have gone to fetch them. Drachas are smart, and even a Strakken as powerful as you can't stand against a pack of them.
She stared him down. He knew something that he wasn't telling her, something important. She could see it in the shift of his eyes and hear it in his voice, but she decided to let it go for the moment. He was right about not lingering. It was too dangerous to stay anywhere for long inside a place like the Forbidding. Everything here was hunter or prey in its turn, and she could not afford to be seen as the latter. She cast about again, trying to decide on a direction. She would have to choose one, whether it would take her anywhere useful or not. She had to get moving, away from this haven for dragons. Geographically, this world was the same as her own. She could use that, if she could just think how. Something about the similarity between the two should suggest a solution, a place to go, a way to survive. She would have liked to use her magic, but she couldn't think of a way in which that would be helpful. The wish song could do many things, but it didn't allow for opening doors between worlds. Besides, she was pretty sure that if she used it for that purpose, the amount of magic required would almost certainly attract unwanted attention. Then, abruptly, she had her answer. She should have seen it at once. If the Forbidding was a mirror of her own world, it would have an equivalent to the Hadeshorn and perhaps a gateway to the Druids. If she could raise their shades here, as she would have been able to do there, she might be able to discover what she should do. As a working idea, it had promise. Besides, since it was the only idea she had, it was worth a try. She looked at Weka Dart. I'm going east, below the dragons, below the mountains. The Ulk Bog furrowed his brow and said something unintelligible, clearly unhappy. You don't have to come with me. I can go alone. She hoped he would agree with her, thinking that he would be of little help in any case. But Weka Dart, still not looking at her, still frowning, shook his head. You may need me to help you find your way, being a stranger. The land is unsafe for strangers. It doesn't get any better where you want to go. Safer west, but I suppose you have your reasons for not going there right away. Maybe later. He looked up suddenly, eyes narrowed. But you don't want to go east. You want to go south, through the mountains. I know you call them something else, but here they are called the Dragon Line. We should go below them before we go east. Too dangerous to try to go back the way I have come. He was so eager to have her do what he wanted that she was immediately suspicious. We can take one of the passes, he continued quickly. That will put us in Pashanon. There are cities and villages. Fortresses, too. Do you know someone there? Another Strakken, perhaps? Clearly he was hiding something, but she had already made up her mind to go the way he was suggesting. She decided to let it drop for now. Listen to me, Weka Dart, she said quietly, kneeling so that she could look him in the eye. She held him frozen in place with the force of her gaze, a prisoner to her eyes. You are not to call me a Strakken again. Is that understood? He nodded hurriedly, mouth twisting, gimlet eyes bright and eager. You are in disguise, he guessed. She nodded. I want my identity kept secret. If you travel with me, you must agree. You must call me Grianne. He laughed, a rather scary sound, all rough edges and rasps. I will do exactly as you wish, so long as you do not knock me out of any more trees. She straightened. Maybe this would work out after all. Maybe she would find a way out of here. Let's be off, she said. Without waiting for his response, she started away. They walked all day, or more accurately, she walked while he scurried, a sort of crab-like motion that employed all four limbs and carried him from one side to the other in a wide-ranging and aimless pattern. She was astonished by his energy, which was boundless, and by his seeming unawareness of the fact that he was covering twice as much ground as was necessary for no reason.
She decided, after watching him scramble about for several hours, that it must be genetic to Ulk Boggs. She knew very little about the species, having only touched on the subject in her reading of the Druid histories, and so had little to go on. Nevertheless, in this case, observation seemed enough. The country they traveled through was both familiar and strange to her, its geographical features similar to those of her own world, but not the same. The differences were often small, ones she could not specifically identify, but only sense. It was not surprising to her that the world of the forbidding, impacted by an alternate history, would not reflect everything exactly. In her world, the topography had been altered by the destructive effects of the Great Wars. The basic landmarks were identifiably the same. The mountains, passes, bluffs, rivers, and lakes, but certain features were changed. The landscape gave her the impression that she was revisiting a familiar place, yet seeing everything in an entirely new light. They did not encounter any other dragons. They saw huge birds flying overhead, ones that were neither rocks nor shrikes, and Wekedart told her they were harpies. She could not make out their women's faces, but could picture them in her mind, narrow and severe, sharp and cunning. Harpies were mythical in her world, thought to be nothing more than the creation of ancient storytellers. But they were among the creatures banished in the time of the creation of the forbidding, and so only the stories remained. To see one here, real and dangerously close, made her think about all the other dangerous things that were here as well, creatures that would hunt her for food or sport or for no reason at all. It was an unpleasant prospect. It had the effect, however, of distracting her. Since her awakening and realization of what had happened to her, she had given little thought to the problems she had left behind. They were distant and just then beyond her control. In a sense, it was liberating. The Druid Council, fractured by its contentious members and constant scheming, was a world away and would have to get on without her as best it could. She hadn't been able to say that in almost 20 years, and there was a certain relief in being able to do so now. The weather inside the Forbidding never changed. Earth and sky rendered gray and colorless by an absence of sunlight and a heavy, unbroken ceiling of clouds that in the distance flashed with lightning and rumbled with thunder. Sunset was little more than a deepening of the gray they had traveled through all day. Vegetation everywhere had a blighted and wintry look to it, as if sickened by the soil in which it grew. Nothing of the world suggested that living things were welcome or encouraged. Everything whispered of death. By day's end, they had reached the southern mouth of one of the passes leading out of the mountains and were looking down from the foothills into the plains that Wekedart called Pashanon, which in her world would be Callahorn. Burnt, stunted grasses grew in clumps over miles of hardpan earth and barren hills that stretched away from countless miles through a scattering of high, windswept plateaus. "We need a safe place to sleep," the Ulk Bog declared in his odd, phlegmy voice, casting about for what he wanted. "Ah, there." He pointed to a huge chestnut set back from the bluff at the edge of a stand of trees that marched upward into the foothills like soldiers. "We have to sleep in a tree?" she asked him doubtfully. He gave her a wicked grin. "Try sleeping on the ground, Strachan, and see what friends you make during the night." She was not happy that he was still calling her Strachan after she had warned him, but she supposed there was no help for it. He addressed her as he saw her, and nothing she said was likely to change that. "Is it safer in the trees?" she asked. "Mostly. We are less visible in the trees, and the worst of the things that hunt at night don't climb. Except for vine serpents." He grinned, his teeth flashing like daggers. "But there are not so many of those this high up." He started away into the trees. "Wait here." He was gone for some time, but when he returned, he was carrying an odd assortment of roots and berries, which he deposited at her feet triumphantly. He clearly thought that this was what she would want to eat, and she decided not to disappoint him. She thanked him, cleaned the food as best she could, and ate it, grateful for the nourishment. Afterwards, he directed her to a small stream. The water seemed clean enough to drink, and so she did. She was aware of the light failing around her, of the darkness settling in, heavy and enfolding. The silence of the day was deepening as well, as if what little noise she had been able to discern on her travels had gone into hiding. The look and feel of the land around her was changing from gloom to murk, the kind of darkness she understood, the kind in which predators flourished. But the darkness here had a different feel to it. Partly it was the absence of moon and stars. Yet the smell and taste of the night air were different too, fetid and rotting, and it carried on its breath the sense of carrion and blood. She felt a tightening in her stomach, a response of her magic to unseen dangers. "Better get up into that tree now," Wekedart urged, looking skittish and uneasy as he led her back from the stream, his side-to-side movements become quick feints. She was aware that he hadn't eaten anything of what he had brought her, and she asked him about it. His response was a grunt of indifference. They climbed the chestnut and settled themselves in a broad cradle formed by a conjoining of branches. Any sort of rest seemed out of the question, she thought, feeling the roughness of the bark digging into her back. She glanced down at her nightgown and found it tattered and falling away. Another day of this, and she would be naked. She had to find some clothes. "Tomorrow," he told her on being asked what she should do. "Villages and camps ahead. Clothes can be found. But you're a Strachan. Can't you make clothes with magic?" She told him no. He seemed confused by this. The hair on the nape of his neck bristled. "Magic can do anything. I've seen it myself. Are you trying to trick me?" "Magic cannot do everything. I should know." She gave him a sharp look. "Anyway, why would I want to trick you? What reason would I have for doing so?" His face tightened. "Everyone knows Strachans have their own reasons for doing things. They like tricking other creatures. They like to see them squirm." He was squirming himself, the fingers of his hands twisting into knots. "You'd better not try to trick me." She laughed in spite of herself. "You seem awfully concerned about being tricked. Why would that be, I wonder? A guilty conscience, perhaps?" His eyes were furious. "I have a right to look out for myself. Strachans are not to be trusted." "I am not a Strachan, Wekedart," she said again. "I've told you that already. Pay attention to me this time. Look at me. I am not a Strachan. I am an Ard Rhys. Say it." He did so, rather reluctantly. He seemed determined that whether she admitted it or not, she was a Strachan and not to be trusted, which made it odd that he had chosen to ally himself with her. Or rather, she corrected, choose her as a traveling companion. Clearly, if he felt as he did about Strachans, he would not travel with her if he could avoid it. It made her wonder what he was after. "I should cover our tracks before the big things start to hunt," he announced suddenly, and disappeared down the trunk of the tree before she could stop him. He was gone a long time, and when he returned, he was gnawing on something he held in one hand. It was hard to tell what it might have been, but it looked as if it was the remains of a ferret or rat. All that was left were the hindquarters. There was blood on the oak bog's mouth and face, and a wicked glint in his eyes. "Tasty," he said. "You look happy enough," she observed, meeting his challenging stare. She had seen much worse than this if he thought to shock her. "Fresh meat," he declared. "Nothing already dead. I'm no scavenger." He consumed what was left with relish, teeth tearing the raw meat into bite-sized shreds that he quickly gulped down. Finished, he wiped his mouth with the back of his hand, licked his fingers, and belched. "Time for sleep," he announced. He stretched himself out on one of the limbs, looking as if sleep would come easily. "Where are your people, Wekedart?" she asked him, too uncomfortable herself even to think of sleeping. "Back where I came from. Still living in their burrows. They are a short-sighted, unimaginative bunch, not like me. That's why I left. I decided there was more for me in life than burrows and roots. But not if I remained with them." What a liar, she thought. Even the way he spoke the words gave him away. He must think she would believe anything. It made her angry. "Where is it you intend to go?" she pressed, keeping her anger carefully hidden. He smacked his lips. "Oh, that's for me to know. I have plans for myself. I may tell you when I get to know you better." "Won't you be missed?" She had put up with this Ulk Bog's deceptions long enough and had decided to do something about it. He was relaxed and unsuspecting. It was a good time to teach him a lesson. She began to hum softly, bringing up the magic of the wish song and layering it about him. Parents? Brothers and sisters? He shrugged, yawned. No family. No friends either, for that matter. Not ones I care about leaving behind. Elk Bogs are a stupid lot, most of them. Can't see beyond their ground roots and mushrooms. Roots can be tender and mushrooms sweet, she ventured, the magic beginning to insinuate itself into his thinking. You were quick enough to bring them to me. Why don't you eat them? He laughed foolishly, the magic taking hold. He had no defense against it. The druid would have brushed her efforts aside effortlessly, but Weka Dart didn't even know what she was doing to him. I could tell you were the sort that ate roots and berries. Not me. I need meat. Fresh meat. Keeps me strong. Makes me dangerous. She had a strong hold over him now, so she began to press harder. Not eating roots was what got you in trouble in the first place, wasn't it? She guessed, guessing at the truth, reading it in his poor attempt at lying. What sort of fresh meat did you eat? It must have been something that was forbidden to Ulk Boggs. More foolishness, he snapped defensively. What difference did it make? They weren't even ours. They were tender, and I only ate a few. There were plenty more where those came from. But you would have thought I had eaten my own children. Instead of someone else's. Another tribe's offspring, useless to everyone. Weren't even missed for a long time. But when they were missed, all my fault. Not even a chance at an explanation. So they drove you out. I left before they could. It was clear what they intended for me, and I saw no reason to endure it. Stupid burrow people. Rodents. They are food for bigger things themselves, little more than rats to dragons and ogres and such. If you don't want to be prey, you have to be predator. I told them this. I told them. What good did it do? What reward did I get? A promise of punishment if I stayed, and no more babies to eat. Impossible. I had a taste for them by then. I couldn't give them up just because the others didn't feel the same way I did. He stopped suddenly and stared at her, wild-eyed. Why did I tell you that? I didn't want to tell you that. Not any of it. But I did. How did that happen? What did you do to me? I helped you come to terms with the truth, little man, she said softly. I don't like liars and deceivers. I was one myself, and I know them for what they are. You were perfectly willing for me to believe that you are traveling about to see the world. But the truth is that you were running away, perhaps from other Ulk Boggs, searching for you because you ate their babies. You want me to protect you, but you don't want to tell me why. All this talk about my tricking you has got to do mostly with you tricking me. You used magic on me. You are a Strachan, just as I said. I am not a Strachan. But Weka Dart was having none of it. He was so incensed he didn't even try to listen to the rest of what she was going to say, leaping to his feet, hissing and spitting like a scorched cat, and baring his teeth at her as if to attack. Then down the tree trunk he skittered, still raging at her, leaping away with a final epithet and disappeared into the dark. She waited for him to return, unable to believe that he wouldn't. Staying with her seemed too important for him to allow his pride to stand in the way. But after a while, when he failed to reappear, she gave up listening for him, deciding that she was better off without him in any case. Anything that would eat its own kind, whatever the reason, was not suitable company. If he stayed, she would have to watch him every minute, always wondering when he might turn on her. Let him go off on his own and be done with it. But in the ensuing silence, she became aware again of how different she felt inside the forbidding. For as much as that world resembled the one she had come from, it was not the same. Where before she had always been comfortable in the darkness, here she was uneasy. The night had a decidedly different feel. Smells, tastes, and sounds were just strange enough to bother her, to make her think that she must watch her every step. She was convinced she could make her way to that world's version of the Hades Horn, if it existed, and attempt a summoning of the shades of the druids. But was she ready for the things she might meet along the way? It was one thing to face down a Dracha, but another altogether to stand against a pack of furies. She was powerful in her world, but how powerful was she in the forbidding? She stared out into the blackness, not at all certain she wanted to find out the answer. Chapter 12. Concentrate, he said, his disembodied voice coming from just over her left shoulder, soft and reassuring. Remember what you are trying to do. Slow and steady. Keep the air moving at the same speed all the time. Breathe through your mind as well as your lungs. She thought that an odd but accurate way of expressing what was needed, and she did her best to comply. Using her skills, she exhaled and then blew the air in a steady, concentrated stream across the clearing to the leaf that hung suspended midair 20 yards away. She watched the leaf hover like a bug, vibrating slightly in response to the gentle currents, reacting to the fingers of magic she was using to control it. A small skill in the larger scheme of things, but one that took her farther than she had gone before. She was getting better at using the magic, at perfecting the druidic talents he sought to teach her, but she was still not as good as either of them wanted her to be. Now, lift gently, Ara and Elicidal instructed, still keeping out of her line of sight, not wishing to distract her any more than was necessary. He understood the delicacy of what she was doing. He preferred that she learn the sophisticated maneuvers first. The ones that relied on power and weight would come later, and more easily. Kyber Elicidal moved the leaf higher, taking it up another 2 feet until it was well out of reach of anyone standing under it. It was harder keeping it aloft, the wind current stronger at the increased height, the force of gravity working with more insistence. She felt impatient with the exercise, as she did with so many, but she was determined to succeed. It was not easy for the daughter and sister of elven kings to persevere, knowing it would be much easier simply to accept the path her father, and now her brother, had laid out for her. But though she was born into the royal family, she had never felt a part of court life, and she did not think that was likely to change. A bird flew by, bright orange and black tipped at its wings and beak. Distracted by its beauty, she lost her concentration, and the leaf fluttered to the earth and lay still. Her uncle came up beside her and placed his hand on her shoulder. He was beautiful, wasn't he? Such a brilliant orange. She nodded, angry and disappointed with herself. I'll never learn anything if I keep letting myself be distracted by beautiful birds. You'll never find any joy in life if you don't. He came around and stood facing her. Don't be so hard on yourself. This takes time. It takes practice. I didn't learn it all at once, either. Warmed by his reassurances, she smiled in spite of herself. They were remarkably alike in personality, both possessed of quiet determination and strong emotions. Their dark features and hair gave them a similar appearance as well, and of late, Kyber was as tall as her uncle, having grown the past year, edging toward womanhood, toward the marriageable age her brother welcomed and she loathed. Fine for him to want to marry her off so that she would be out of his hair, but that didn't make it right for her. She loved her brother, but he was nothing like her. In fact, aside from her mother, the member of the family she was closest to was standing right in front of her. No one wanted to hear that, of course, since her uncle was not welcome in Arbalan. He had become, over the course of the years, the member of the family that the others were ashamed to acknowledge. They would have locked him away if he had been foolish enough to try to make a life with them, but Ara and Elicidal had decided to go another way a long time ago. He patted her shoulder and glanced at the sky through the heavy canopy of tree limbs. Midday. Why don't we have something to eat before we continue? It is easier to concentrate when your stomach isn't rumbling. Which hers was, she realized with embarrassment. Sometimes she could barely tolerate herself, a vessel for shortcomings and ungovernable urges that betrayed her at every turn. She followed him back through the woods to the village, her strides matching his, thinking that food would be good and his company over a glass of ale even better. She loved talking with her uncle, just talking with him. He was so interesting. He had done so many things in his life. He was not yet 40, and he was recognized everywhere as a druid of immense importance and power. The Ardreese herself considered him indispensable, and she had visited him many times over the years, although Kyber had never been fortunate enough to be present when she did. Aran Elicidal had sailed on the Jarl Shanra with the Ardreese, her brother Beck, and a handful of others whose names were now legendary. He had been one of the fortunate ones to survive. If not for him, the Ardreese might have failed in her efforts to restore the Druid Council at Paranor. It was his support of Grianne Ohmsford that had cost Aran his place at court, that had earned him rebuke and exile from first his brother and now his brother's son. He had deserved neither, in her opinion, but she was alone in her support, and was herself increasingly isolated by the male members of the Elicidal House. Well, it hardly mattered in her uncle's case, given the use to which he had put his life. He had gone to Paranor with the first of the new druids and studied the druidic arts with the Ardreese. He was not blessed with natural talent, his sole use of magic previously confined to the elf stones he had retrieved on his long-ago voyage. But he was a quick study and had an affinity for tapping into earth magic, which was at the heart of all druid studies. He learned quickly, becoming strong enough to take his talent back into the Westland 15 years ago, to the village of Emberon, where he had devoted his life to caring for the land and its people. He was good at what he did, and all had benefited greatly, no matter what the others in her family thought. The problem, of course, was that none of them could get past what they perceived as Aran's betrayal of his father, who had died at the hands of assassins dispatched by the Ardreese, when she was still the Ill's Witch. They could not forgive Aran for tricking his elder brother, who became king afterwards, into sending elves to serve as druids under the woman who had killed their father. That he would be a part of such subterfuge, knowing as he did the truth of things, proved to be incendiary once it was discovered. An order of exile was issued immediately, and all were forbidden even to speak his name. By then he was already gone, of course, studying with the Ardreese and those he had brought to serve her, the first of many who would come to Paranor. Even the fact that the Ardreese had been transformed so utterly by the power of the Sword of Shannara made no difference to the Elicidals. Nothing would satisfy them, short of seeing her dead and gone. That would change when enough time had passed and enough new kings had ascended the Elicidal throne, but change of that sort was very slow. "How much longer will you be able to stay with me?" Aran asked her suddenly. She laughed. "Anxious for me to be gone, now that you've seen how inept I am?" "You have put your finger on it," he agreed. "Nevertheless, I am concerned about your brother's response to your increasingly frequent visits." Kellan hated her visits to Emberon, but even as king he could not do much to prevent them. She had told him as much, suggesting that he had enough to worry about with the war on the Precandoran. He had inherited the war after their father was killed, and Kellan had made it his life's mission to see it concluded with a freeborn victory, something that at present looked none too likely. Between governing the elves and waging his pet war, Kellan had little time for her. She knew he hated his uncle, but he ignored Aran because it was easier than taking more direct action. Of course, Kellan didn't yet realize the nature of her visits. If he discovered what she was up to, or more to the point, when he discovered it, he would put a stop to things in a heartbeat. But by then, she hoped, she would be a student at Paranor and beyond his reach. She hadn't told her uncle yet, but she thought he must suspect as much. She was not in line for the throne, since her brother had produced male heirs and the line of succession ran down the male side of the family ladder, until it stopped and females were all that were left. So it shouldn't matter to the rest of her family what she did so long as she stayed out of the way. For the moment she was willing to accept that compromise, having little interest in Arbalan and family in any event, though there were times when her resolve was sorely tested. "My brother is off visiting the Precandoran," she said, brushing Aran's concerns aside. "He gives little thought to me. For the most part he doesn't even know where I am. He doesn't know now, as a matter of fact." Aran looked at her. "Does anyone?" "Mother." He nodded. "Your passion for the druidic arts, for elemental magic's secrets, can't sit well with her. She sees you married and producing grandchildren.
Kyber grunted. She sees poorly these days. But then I don't do much to enlighten her.
She would only worry, and Kellen gives her reason enough for that. Besides, she has grandchildren.
My brother's sons, good, stout warrior lads, all three. They fill her grandmotherly needs nicely.
They walked into the village and down the single road that formed its center, to Aran's small cottage at the far end. He had built it himself and continued to work on it from time to time, telling her he found working with his hands relaxing. He kept a project in the works at all times, the better perhaps to get through the demands of his service to the Westland. At present he was installing a new roof, a shingle shake overlay that required hand-splitting new shingles to replace the old. It was taxing and time-consuming, which, she supposed, was just what he wanted. They sat at a small outdoor table in the sunlight and ate cheese, apples, and bread washed down with cold ale from his earth cellar. Food and drink always tasted better in Embrun than at home. It had to do with the company, but also with the life of the village. In Embrun, she was just Kyber to everyone she knew, not princess or highness or some other deferential term. Nothing was expected of her save common courtesy and decent manners. She was just like everyone else, or as much so as was possible in a world of iniquities. Her command of the druid magic set her apart, of course, just as it did Arryn. Well, not as much so as Arryn, who was more highly skilled in its use. But the point was that the villagers regarded the use of elemental magic as a trade, a craft of great value and some mystery, but ultimately of much good. Her uncle had never done anything to persuade them otherwise, and she intended to follow in his steps. She knew the history of magic in the Four Lands, both within and without the family. All too often magic had caused great harm, sometimes unintentionally. In many places it was still mistrusted and feared. But with the formation of the new Druid Council, the Ardris had mandated that magic's use embody caution and healing in order for it to be sanctioned. In spite of her checkered past, or perhaps because of it, she had dedicated the Druid Order to that end. Kyber had witnessed the results of that commitment in the nature of the service undertaken by druids like her uncle, who had left Paranor and gone out into the Four Lands to work with its people. The effect of their efforts was apparent. Slowly but surely, the use of elemental magic was being accepted everywhere. She would undertake such a mission as well, one day soon. She would study at Paranor and then go out into the Four Lands to apply her skills. She was determined to make something of her life beyond what the others in her family had envisioned. It was her life, after all, not theirs. She would live it the way she chose. "I want to work with the stones again this afternoon," she announced, thinking suddenly of something else entirely and feeling a sudden heat rise to her face. One of their lessons was in the cracking open of rocks by touch and thought applied in precise combination, a technique in which envisioning a result leads to its happening. A druid could manage it just as easily as tearing paper between fingers. She hadn't found the skill for it herself, but she was determined it would be hers. "We can do that," he agreed, "so long as you swear to me that you are not violating any promises or arousing any concerns by being here."
"Nothing out of the ordinary. I have another week before my brother returns and looks to find everything the way he left it. I will be back by then."
"But not before you show me what you know about what I carry," she thought to herself. "My secret for now, but I will reveal it to you before I leave, and you will teach me to make use of it." Her heart pounded at the prospect. She was uncertain how her request would be received, uncertain for that matter of his reaction to what she had done. She had taken an enormous chance, but she had learned a long time ago that if you didn't take chances now and then in a royal family, nothing ever was permitted you that you really wanted. Mostly her family wanted to keep her safe and compliant, and she had never wanted to be either of those. It was surprising to her that after all these years, any of them really thought she would ever be docile. When she was little, she was her brother's worst nightmare. Kellen was older and stronger, but she was always the more daring. She learned everything first and learned it quicker. She was the better rider, her bond with horses instinctual and passionate. She was better with weapons, able to battle him to a draw when he was a head taller and she barely strong enough to wield the practice blades. When he was intent on his studies of court practices and statesmanship, she was off wandering the forests and river country that surrounded her home. At 8, she ran away and got as far as the Serendanon before a family of wheat farmers recognized her and brought her back. At 12, she had already flown in an airship all the way to Callahorn, stowed away in the hold until she was discovered. And all that didn't even touch on the times she had disguised herself as an elven hunter to go off on dangerous forays into country so wild that if her father had been alive, she would have been locked in her rooms for a month when she was brought back. But he wasn't alive by then. He was dead, killed on the Precandoran. Her brother was king, and he was still intimidated by her. He gave her a lecture that would have scorched paint in a rainstorm before turning his mind to less troublesome concerns, but a lecture was nothing to her. She brushed back her thick, unruly hair. Sometimes she thought she should just cut it all off and be done with it, but her mother would have reacted to that much the same way she would have reacted if Kyber had announced she was going to marry a troll. There was no point in antagonizing her mother, who was her sole source of support and confidence. She finished off her cheese and bread, watching her uncle surreptitiously. It was hard to know what he was thinking. His expression never really changed, the result of his druid discipline, which taught that emotions must be contained if magic was to be successfully wielded. She wanted to tell him what she had done when he was in a good mood. But how could she know? She grimaced. She recognized what she was doing. She was procrastinating. She should just tell him, right here, right now. Nevertheless, she did not. She finished her glass of ale, rose, and began to clear the table of plates and glasses. It was one of the small services she could perform on her visits, and she liked doing something for her uncle that no one else would. He lived alone, and some said he did so because he preferred it that way. He had been in love a long time ago with a seer on the Gerald Shannara, though he had never said as much when speaking of her. He had been only a boy himself in those days, younger even than she was now, and much more sheltered. The seer had been killed on the voyage, and Kyber was fairly sure he had never gotten over it. She had done something important for him, something that had helped him grow into the man he was, although once again he never said exactly what that something was. Since then there had been only one other woman, a sorceress, who had loved him desperately. Kyber had seen them together, and it was frightening how determined the other woman was that Aran Elicidal should be hers. But he had decided otherwise and never spoke of her now. Apparently she was as exiled from his life as he was from Arbalan's. "Have you ever thought about returning to Pelennor?" she asked impulsively, pausing on her way into the house with the dishes. He looked at her. "Now and then. But I think I belong here in the Westland. Pelennor is a place for study and druid politics. Neither is for me." "What are you really asking, Kyber?" She made a face. "Nothing. I just wondered if you ever missed the company of other druids, the ones who still remain at Pelennor." "You mean her," he said, his smile sad and ironic. He was too quick, she thought. He could read her mind. "No," he said. "That's done. I just think it would help if you had someone living here with you, someone to help you, so you wouldn't be lonely." It sounded stupid even to her. He laughed. "Well, it wouldn't be her in any case. She isn't the kind to help others when she has herself to worry about. Why are you so eager to see me partnered? I don't see you looking around for someone to marry." She stalked into the house without replying, thinking that her good intentions were wasted on her uncle. He was right about her, of course, but that was beside the point. She was too young to marry, and he would soon be too old and too set in his ways. In fact, he already was, she decided. There was no room in his life for anything but his work. She didn't know why she thought that it might be otherwise. He would live alone until he died, and she might as well accept it. She would just have to do the best she could for him on her visits and hope he got by the rest of the time. She had just returned for the rest of the dishes when she heard a shout from the other end of the village, and elves came running out of their houses and workshops, looking skyward. "An airship," Aran said, getting to his feet at once. No airships ever came to Emberon. It was too small and too isolated. There was only one road, and much of the year it was sodden and rutted and virtually impassable by wagon or cart. Khyber always came on horseback, knowing that she could be assured of getting in and out again that way. Flying vessels in that part of the world were rare. Some of the elves who lived in the village had never even seen one. She followed Arryn down the road and through the village toward the sound of the shouting, joining the flow of the crowd and trying to make out the ship through the heavy canopy of limbs. She had no idea where it might find a place to land in woods as heavy as those surrounding Embrun, but she supposed there must be a large enough clearing somewhere nearby. Arryn was striding ahead, gray druid robes whipping about his ankles, and she thought from the purposeful nature of his walk that he was concerned that whoever had taken the trouble to fly an airship to Embrun might not have their best interests at heart. A rush of excitement flooded through her at the prospect of whom it might be. Maybe the routine of her studies was about to take an unexpected but rather more interesting turn. The crowd reached the end of the road and turned down a pathway that led into the trees. Overhead, she caught a glimpse of movement. The airship appeared momentarily and was gone, again circling the trees. It wasn't very big, a skiff at best. She broke into a narrow clearing just as the airship started down, a slow, looping motion that brought it in line with a narrow opening in the forest canopy. She could see it clearly by then, a small skiff of the sort favored by Southlanders who did their flying across the inland lakes. Even though it was coming down at a precipitous decline, she didn't think that its power had failed. Nevertheless, given the tightness of the space, the pilot was taking a dangerous risk. Whoever was flying had better be pretty good, or the airship would end up in pieces in the trees. "They're landing!" someone belatedly cried out in surprise. As the pilot continued to maneuver toward the slot, the elves scattered back into the trees, pointing and shouting. Khyber stood her ground, not wanting to miss the details of the landing. She had flown on airships, but never seen one landed in a space so small. She wanted to see how it was done. She wanted to see if the pilot could do it. She got more than she bargained for. It appeared the craft would touch down before it reached her, but at the last minute it lurched drunkenly, skipped across the forest floor, and came right at her. If Arryn hadn't yanked her out of the way and thrown her down, she might have been struck by the pieces of metal that broke loose and flew wildly in all directions. The little skiff slammed into the ground, tore open huge ruts with its pontoons, and came to a halt not 20 feet from where she crouched. Arryn released his grip on her arm and stood her back up. "You need to pay better attention, Khyber," he said quietly. She rubbed her arm and shrugged carelessly. "Sorry, Uncle Arryn. I just wanted to watch." The elves began to filter out of the trees for a look at the airship's occupants, one of whom, a boy who was younger than she was, stood on the skiff's deck, surveying the damage and shaking his head. She stared. Was he the one who had been flying the skiff? This boy? Then a second head popped up from one of the storage holds in the starboard pontoon, a dwarf who looked as if he didn't know whether to strangle the boy or embrace him. "Is that Tagwyn?" Arryn whispered in disbelief. "Shades, I think it is. What is he doing here?" With Khyber right beside him, he hurried forward to find out. Chapter 13 Penderyn Ormsford hauled himself out of the pilot box, brushed off his rumpled clothes, and surveyed the little skiff with no small sense of satisfaction. Another vessel would have broken apart on impact, coming in as fast and as hard as she had. That they were down safely at all was a miracle, but he had survived tougher landings and had never really been in doubt about the outcome. Tagwyn did not share that reaction. The dwarf was incensed as he climbed out of the storage bin into which he had fallen and pointed a shaking finger at the boy. "What's the matter with you? Are you trying to kill us? I thought you said you could fly this thing. Didn't you tell me you could? Why, your aunt thinks you're so good at flying escapes me. I could have done a better job myself." His beard was matted with leaves and twigs and dirt clots, and a rather large leaf stuck out of his hair like a feather, but he failed to notice the full weight of his attention given over to Pen. Pen shrugged. "We're down, we're safe, and we're walking away," he pointed out. "I think that ought to be good enough." "Well, it isn't good enough," Tagwyn snapped. "Well, why not?" "Because we should be dead. This time we were lucky. What about next time? What about the time after that?
I'm supposed to be able to depend on you. I said I would come with you in search of the arteries, but I didn't say I would commit suicide. I don't see why you're so angry, Penn snapped, made angry himself by the other's irascible behavior. Tagwin, is that you? As I live and breathe, it is. Well met. The shout came from one side, drawing their attention and putting an end to their arguing. The speaker was an elf about the same age as Penn's father, but with more careworn face and with an even slighter build. A girl walked beside him, darker complected and more intense. Her eyes were riveted on Penn, and he had the feeling that she was making up her mind about him before she even knew who he was. Then she smiled when she saw him looking back at her, a disarming warm grin that made him regret his hasty conclusion. Tagwin, the speaker exclaimed again, reaching up to take the dwarf's hand. What are you doing out here, and on an airship? Desperate times require desperate acts, Tagwin advised philosophically. He extended his own hand, and they shook. I must say, flying with this boy is as desperate as I care to get. He paused, glancing over at Penn ruefully. Although I will admit, in all fairness, that he has saved my life several times on our journey. He reached out a hand and guided Penn to the forefront. Penn Darren Holmesford, this is R.N. Elicidal. You might have heard your father speak of him. Ah, young Penn, the elf greeted enthusiastically, shaking his hand as well. I haven't seen you since you were too tiny to walk. You probably don't remember me. My father does indeed speak of you all the time, Penn agreed. My mother as well. They were good friends to me on our voyage west, Penn. If not for your father's help, I would not have returned. He gestured toward the girl. This is my niece, Kyber, my brother's daughter. She visits from Arbalon. Hello again, Kyber, Tagwin nodded to her. You have grown up. Not all that far, she replied, her eyes staying on Penn. That was a spectacular landing, she said. I didn't think you were going to make it down. Tagwin went crimson again, the disapproving frown returning to his bluff features, so Penn jumped down from the decking with a mumbled thanks and quickly added, Tagwin's right. I was lucky. I think it was more than that, she said. How long have you been flying airships? Enough about airships, the dwarf huffed, noticing for the first time the debris in his beard and brushing it clean with furious strokes. We have other things to talk about. He lowered his voice. Prince Aren, can we go somewhere more private? Elves were gathered all around by then, come out of the trees to take a closer look at the airship and its occupants. Children were already scurrying around the pontoons and under the decking, making small, excited noises amid squeals of delight. A few of the braver ones were even trying to climb aboard while their parents pulled them back. My cottage is just up the road, Tagwin, Aren Elicidal said. We can clean you up and give you something to eat and drink. Kyber makes the best mango black tea in the Westland, a secret she won't share, even with me. He gave the girl a wink. Leave the skiff. She'll be all right where she is. She's an object of curiosity, but the villagers won't harm her. I don't care whether they harm her or not, Tagwin groused. I've had more than enough of her for one day, thanks very much. They walked back through the village, R.N. Elicidal leading with Tagwin at his side, Penn following with Kyber. No one said very much, respecting the dwarf's wishes that they wait until they were in private to talk. Penn was thinking that even though Tagwin had insisted the elven prince-turned-druid could help them in their search for the arteries, R.N. didn't look up to it. If anything, he looked too soft and frail for the physical demands of such an endeavor. A strong wind might blow him away, the boy thought. But looks were misleading. R.N. Elicidal had survived the voyage of the Gerald Shannara when more than 20 others had not, and he wasn't a druid then. Tagwin had warned Penn not to judge R.N. too quickly, that what was visible on the surface was not necessarily representative of the man inside. Penn hoped he was right. Your father is Beck Holmesford, Kyber Elicidal asked him. He nodded. Do you know the story from your uncle? All of it. It is the most famous story of this generation. My family doesn't much care for it because they hold your aunt responsible for my grandfather's assassination, and Uncle Aren responsible for helping her escape them and found the new druid order at Perenor. My brother is the worst. I don't agree with any of them. That's why I'm here. I am training with my uncle to be a druid. In secret. Your family doesn't know. She shook her head. They think I come here only to visit, so they leave me alone. They don't know the truth.
He stepped a little closer, lowering his voice.
My parents don't know where I am. They think I am still back in Patch Run.
What will they do when they find out you're not?
He smiled.
Track me down. They can do it, too. But they won't find out for a while. They are off in the Anar on an expedition, guiding customers, hunting and fishing. They won't get back for weeks, so they won't know.
She smiled back.
Looks like we have something in common. They reached Aran's cottage, where the druid provided Pen and Tagwin with fresh clothes, a bucket of water, and cloths with which to wash up. The pair did so and returned to find that Kyber had prepared the promised black tea and set out some cheese and bread as well. Since neither had eaten since early morning when they had set out from somewhere below the Myrmidon, they devoured the food hungrily and drank down the entire pot of tea. When they were finished, Tagwin rocked back in his seat, glanced across the table at Aran to be certain he was listening, and said, "I'll tell you why we've come now, but it might not be something you want to share with Kyber." He gave her a pointed look. "No offense is meant, young lady, but the truth is you might be better off not knowing what we have to say. There is some danger involved." The girl looked at her uncle, who shrugged. "I am not much good at keeping secrets from Kyber," he said, smiling. "In any case, she would have it out of me before the sun was down. If you don't mind, I'll let her stay to hear your story."
Tagwin nodded.
"She can quit listening when she decides she doesn't want to hear any more. I'll leave it at that."
Leaning forward, arms resting on the tabletop, bearded face scrunched up so that he looked as if he was about to undertake the most difficult task of his life, he began his story. He related the events surrounding the disappearance of the Ardris, the dismissal of Kermadec and his rock trolls, his own decision to seek help from Grianne's brother, his arrival at Patch Run and meeting with Pen, and their subsequent flight from Terek Molt and the crew of the druid airship Gallifile. He ended with the unexpected appearance of the King of the Silver River, come out of nowhere to save them from Terek Molt.